Lieutenant Colonel Robert Schaefer. Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer received his master's degree from Harvard University's Russia, East Europe, and Central Asian program. So similarly, a Russian-Eurasian-oriented master's degree program. That's where we first met. And he's a multi-talented individual, as you'll hear in a moment, but he combines the worlds of policy, academia, and military. His critically acclaimed book on Russia, The Insurgency in Chechnya and the North Caucasus from Ghazavat to Jihad, has won multiple national awards. It was named a best of 2011 by Circus Reviews, and it was one of the top 150 books on terrorism and counterterrorism. A little bit of a... And he...
It's not about Russian politics.
Right. Sorry, Curtis. All right. He's also published numerous articles and contributed a chapter to The Fire Below, How the Caucasus Has Changed Russia, published by Bloomsbury in 2013. And he's also contributed to the book Operation Homecoming, published by Random House 2006. If you look up his books on Amazon, you will find them for sale. You will also find the author web page with other information. Lieutenant Colonel Robert Schaefer is a U.S. Army Special Forces officer, a Green Beret, diplomat, and a senior international defense expert with over 26 years working with senior foreign defense and military officials. He is, as I mentioned, a critically acclaimed award-winning author, also a consultant to several U.S. government agencies, and a frequent contributor for major media and seminars focused on terrorism and insurgency in Russia, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. Moreover, he will be the Caucasus correspondent slash consultant for NBC's coverage of the 2014 Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia. I'm sure one of the least interesting things you've done so far. He currently serves as chief of Central and South Asia branch for Army Central Command, working with senior foreign government and military leaders and managing a team of military and civilian specialists to develop, coordinate, and implement bilateral security cooperation plans, build partner capacity, and improve the overall regional security environment for Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the countries of Central Asia and the North Arabian Sea. In the past, Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer has served as a Special Forces Engineering and Demolition Sergeant, military attaché to the country of Estonia, and he has also served in U.S. embassies in Moscow, Russia, Kiev, and Ukraine. Moreover, he is winner of numerous awards and medals, including the Abrams Award as the top ROTC cadet in the United States, the Singlab Award as USOCOM's Person of the Year for his historic achievements with the Russian Airborne Forces. For his time in Estonia, he received the Estonian Defense Forces Distinguished Service Cross, the Ministry of Defense's Cross of Merit, and the White House Cross of the Estonian Kaitseliit. The only foreigner in contemporary Estonian history to have been decorated by all three organizations. I believe we could not have made up a more impressive bio than this. So it is my great pleasure in welcoming Lieutenant Colonel Schaefer.
But I will say the hardest thing I ever did was get Professor Herrera to like one of my papers. So, and if you've ever done a paper for her before, you know exactly what I mean. So what I would like to do today is, a few of you were here for the earlier session, and what we talked about there were some careers. So really what this is a kind of a multitask here. This is gonna be a continuation of what I talked about earlier, which were careers focused specifically on Central and South Asia. And in particular there, I was talking about some analysis and policy work and some of the things that we're going to do. So my expectation here is that everybody in this room can tell me where Uzbekistan is. If you're not, it's okay. I just kind of need to know that right now. Yeah? Does everybody like to talk about Uzbekistan? Do you realize how strange you are to be in a room of people who are going to sit and talk about Uzbekistan for a while? You should give yourselves a pat on the back. We're going to have fun, okay? We're going to geek out on policy papers for the next hour or so. What we're going to do is where I talked a little bit earlier today about what it is that we do, we're actually going to do it now. So what I'm going to present you with is a real policy paper that we're working on right now. I'm going to talk to you about how we came up with it, why we're doing it, and I'm going to walk you through that process the way I do with my analytical staff. And as we go through the rules, I'm going to tell you what my expectations are from you, but I think we can have a lot of fun with this. Most importantly, you'll actually then, your comments will go into, you know, what goes up as a real policy paper. Okay, so we're going to do real work today, and we should be able to have some fun. So we've done some introductions. Mostly what I'll need to know from you in terms of introductions is if I'm going over something that you don't know, and we need to pull back a little bit. And to do that, we're going to first of all talk about my assumptions on what your knowledge base is. So we'll go over that for a while. We'll go over some ground rules on how we'll do this. We'll talk about the background on the issue and what is the burning question. Now, for those of you, do I have any undergrads? Yeah, so hey, guess what? You know, all those papers you hate to write, you know, this is actually what you're supposed to get to someday. This is the point of doing, of learning how to write, because ultimately, you want to hopefully get to the point where when you write stuff makes a difference, okay? And when your professors and everybody talks to you about, you know, the most important thing is what is the question? Well, the reason is because that's why we really write papers in the real world. We have a question that needs to get answered, and we'll walk through that question. And then I'm gonna present major points from this paper, and I'm going to ask you to challenge them, all right? So you're gonna be, well, it's kind of like a dissertation, right? Or we call it in the military, we call it a murder board, okay? This is a murder board. The idea is I'm gonna give you the points from the real paper, okay? And I want you to tell me where I'm wrong. I'm gonna give you some conclusions. I want you to tell me where I'm wrong or what I'm missing, all right? And then at the end, we'll go and we'll ask for some further analysis, any of your comments or questions, all right? Everybody agree to that? Then let's have fun with foreign policy, you bunch of foreign policy geeks, okay? How often do you get to do that? All right, this is what I need to make sure that you know, okay? These are my assumptions about your knowledge if you're here. If you're not good on this, then raise your hand and I'll do some real quick background, okay? It's okay if you don't know, but we all have to be on the same sheet of music. All right, so you cannot have a conversation about Uzbekistan if you do not bring up the Rogun Dam, right? Because the Uzbeks have already said quite openly that if the Tajiks build the Rogun Dam, which will be the world's highest dam, because you know in Tajikistan they like to build the world's tallest flagpole and lots of other things like that, as opposed to putting in real roads. What will happen is if they put that in, then the Uzbeks, who rely very heavily on the water that comes down from the mountain for their cotton crops, they believe it's going to seriously hurt their economy. The Uzbeks are also concerned because the time that the Tajiks will want to keep the water at the dam is exactly the opposite of when the Uzbeks need that to happen, because what the Tajiks need to do is they need to generate enough electricity so they can support themselves. They can't do it right now. Every year there's a real problem with electricity in Tajikistan, okay? So the Tajiks need the dam. They want the dam. They said they're gonna build the dam. The Uzbeks said, if you build the dam, we're gonna fight. Do not approve this, okay? Karambada 1 is a similar project that's going on in Kyrgyzstan, but when you talk about what goes on in Central Asia, you gotta know about these two dams and you gotta know about these hydroelectric issues. Otherwise, you can't really talk about the security environment. All right, you know who the IMU and the Taliban are, as well as the basic issues surrounding Central Asian concerns regarding the post-2014 security environment. In a word, post-2014 U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is what keeps the Central Asian countries up at night. That's what everybody talks about all the time. I just ran my own conference with all the leaders of the Central Asian ground forces and or their ground forces commanders, and that's all anybody wants to talk about is what are we going to do? So you got to know some of those things. We already talked a little bit about water, but you should also have a good idea here to understand all the points that we're going to make about what Central Asian resources are. It's not just water and land, it's also gas. That's an important point because that is what drives Uzbekistan's policy sometimes. Now the Kazakhs, it's fun to watch these guys have this thing. The Kazakhs already know that they are the regional hegemon, and they're not worried about being in charge or being seen as the elder brother in Central Asia. They've already moved on. The Kazakhs are saying, I want to be a player on the world stage. I want to be important in the oil and gas community. I'm not going to try and prove that I'm the most important country in Central Asia. But the Uzbeks still aspire to their old role in the Soviet Union as that center. All right, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the Collective Security Treaty Organization. The CSTO is like Warsaw Pact Light. It is how Russia attempts to influence foreign policy there and to keep itself relevant in security affairs in Central Asia in particular, right? And the SCO is run by China. Russia wants everybody to believe that it's actually a major player in the SCO, and China just kind of chuckles on the side. But that dynamic is important if you want to understand where we're going to go with this, because ultimately, my concern when we get to the question that is my burning question, which is whether Uzbekistan in terms of multilateral organizations, okay? And what is important is about Uzbekistan's formal withdrawal from CSTO, formally now 4 or 5 months ago, something like that, okay? The Uzbek military is by far the most professional in Central Asia. I know we've got somebody from Kazakhstan here today. They will maybe argue with that a bit, but having seen both of them, the Uzbeks are good. They are really, really good, and they are really, really professional. Uzbekistan has 30 million people. Kazakhstan, being twice the landmass, has 15 million people. Uzbekistan military dwarfs that of Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. And why does that matter? Well, Tajikistan's going to build that dam. And they are worried, worried, worried about the Uzbeks. All right, the NDN, Northern Distribution Network, goes through Central Asia. And that's where the New Silk Road Initiative comes from as well there too. All of these things are important in terms of understanding the security environment. All right. You kind of know what we do in Central Asia. I know it really well. You guys kind of know it too. But most importantly, you have to understand what Russia and China are trying to do there as well too. In particular, I think we can point, in fact, I'll just go on record even though we are on tape, but the reason that the Manas Transit Center is going to shut down or going to turn over to complete civilian control in the Kyrgyz government is because the Russians do not want us there. They want the US out. Now, I can't tell you that's official policy. I can't tell you that comes from a particular cable, but I'm just telling you, I know. So that's what happened. The Russians don't want us there. And the Russians consider Central Asia to be its, and I'm gonna get stuck on that word again. It's not unique, it's sphere of influence, okay? So nobody else is allowed to be there. And excess defense articles is EDA. Anybody here know what EDA is who's not in the military? You do?
Yeah.
Great. So for the rest of you, EDA, excess defense articles, a huge thing right now, because as we leave Afghanistan, US forces would like to do it as inexpensively and efficiently as possible. To do that, what would be nice is if some of the stuff that we don't think we're going to need, well, we make that available for other countries to come in and purchase it. So they got to pick it up, they got to take it as is. So in other words, we're not going to ship it back because it's too expensive. But if you want our stuff, come get it. The problem with this is that Uzbekistan put in a huge package, and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan are petrified if we give the Uzbeks some of our combat vehicles. And yet, if the Uzbeks don't get some EDA, they're going to look at us again and say, you guys are terrible partners. We do all this for you. We run the NDN for you. We make all this stuff happen for you. You made us all these promises, and seriously, You can't give us some old beat up vehicles that we're going to pay for ourselves, really? Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are saying, please, please do not give them anything, nothing, no, 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 no. Even Kazakhstan's worried about it. When you get the Kazakhs telling us that they're worried about it, then you got to be worried. Okay, so that's what we need to understand, all of that stuff, to get to a policy paper. Because ultimately, well, let's talk about the rules here first. Okay, so I am not the expert on Central Asia, as you are all. I am an ardent and motivated student of Central Asia. Okay, so what I will need you today, do today, is to tell me when I'm wrong. Okay, I need your brains. If anybody knew the real answer to this question, then we wouldn't be writing a real policy paper on it. That's what we're doing today, and that's I need your help to do that. So don't be afraid to suggest something. If somebody does talk, we're going to use the talking stick method, and that is we don't move on to the next person until the person who is speaking believes that everybody gets their point. Okay, that way we ensure we don't move on until it is the proper time to do so. All right, and I anticipate with all my analysts, and I do with you as well, is that we will have civil discussion. It's being taped, remember? I will need somebody, please, to just take some, not notes of the whole thing, but what I expect is that as you raise some good questions of things in this paper that I need to deal with, I need somebody to write that down for me so that I'm not taking time. So it would be something simple as, please write that down. I hope, you know, it'd be nice if you agree with everything that I say today, and I don't have to have anybody do that. But if I do, and I expect that you will, would somebody please take some notes for me? Great, thank you. All right, since we're on camera, be sure to refer to my book or my other work as brilliant at least once, so it's caught on camera. That's a joke. All right, let's have some fun. You are all policy geeks, otherwise you wouldn't be here, so let's have some fun. All right, so this is the situation. Go ahead and read that. And that is ultimately kind of the background that I need you to think about. This is directly from the paper. So now, based on this, what I saw is that there are some things that aren't making sense. If, for the past couple of years, Karimov and Uzbekistan have been the ones that have most consistently been pushing their hands, pushing Russia away, saying, we don't want you. And if the Uzbeks have decided to formally leave the CSTO, then what's up with the lovey-dovey stuff here with Putin, you know? Especially when before the meeting, you know, there was more of the same thing that we expected. So the question is, kind of what does that mean? So what is Uzbekistan up to? That's really the question. What does this mean? That's what I really want to know. Now, why is this important? Because really, we have to make recommendations to policy folks on what they should do. And as I mentioned in my first class today, big policymakers, okay, there's policy and there's policy. There's big P policy, right? That's done by a DASD when he goes to another country and says, these are your broad outlines of what you're going to do. But those guys don't really make policy. Most of the policy gets done actually at my level and the action officer level because we're doing little P policy. But when we get these broad guidelines, that just tells me what I can't do. And then I've got all this maneuver room here on the inside. And then we're the ones who kind of pick what's going on. So when those big P policy folks go in, all right, I always think of them as working for me. If I got a DASD going in, I'm saying to him, hey, sir or ma'am, this is what I need from you, because this is where I think, and I pull out my charts and I say, this is where we've been going with this particular country. This is where we need to go. This is all in line with everything else, okay? And this is what I need when you go in and make that big P. These are the lanes that I need. So see, a lot of times policy can work both ways. Policy can work when you get from the president down in terms of what is it we're gonna do, but it can also work up. And it's most effective when it works from the bottom up. When I go to the policymaker or people like me and say, this is what I need you to carve out for me so that I have enough freedom of maneuver to actually do some good work. So why? We gotta figure this question out, exactly what Uzbekistan's gonna do. I've gotta start putting resources towards that. I'm gonna have to start getting other people to agree to what it is that I need to do. And for me to do that, I have to be able to provide them with the context to say why it is we're gonna do and why I'm gonna spend your taxpayer money in Central Asia, right? And how it's going towards, you know, the right goals. Right, why are we doing it? Most people don't even know where Tajikistan is. All right, so when you're talking to your leadership half the time, they're gonna come to us, they're coming to the Central Asian experts. That's why we're doing it. And that's why, quite honestly, I thought that this was a great thing for us to do today, because you're the Central Asia folks, right? You're gonna tell me where I'm wrong on this. And really, why am I thinking specifically about Uzbekistan? Well, Uzbekistan's a wild card. I worry about Uzbekistan. I like the Uzbeks, I love going to Tashkent. I don't know what they're up to. And that worries me. Kazakhstan's pretty good. They got a nice, clear glide path. We're happy with where they're going. They're happy with where they're going. They're in great shape. Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, okay, well, we know where they're going as well, too. They're gonna continue to be kind of influenced by the 800-pound bear in their backyard. And there's not gonna be that much that we can do about that. Turkmenistan is Turkmenistan, positive neutrality, and they are going to continue that, and we will do what we can with Turkmenistan, but we're not worried about them. They have a lot of oil and gas. They're going to be fine. But we got the Rogun Dam, but we have the largest population in Central Asia, but we have the best trained military in Central Asia, right? What's Uzbekistan going to do? I need to know that. Plus, we have issues with Karimov and his secession issues, right? Lots and lots of wild cards there. Right, so what started all of this is, again, when the Uzbeks withdrew, then they got all cuddly with President Putin. And what I want to know is, in the past, Uzbekistan, prior to the Afghan war, prior to the until we get out of Afghanistan, okay, we have a kind of a security arrangement that we have with everybody in Central Asia right now. Post-2014, that's going to change. We all know it's going to change. What I need to know is how it's going to change, because post-2014 is almost upon us, and that's what we got to be thinking about. So, is Uzbekistan going the route of Turkmenistan? Are they going to try and do positive neutrality, or a phrase that I made up? Remember to quote me if you ever use it again. Aggressive bilateralism. In other words, are they only gonna try and do bilateral stuff? Or is it gonna be something in between? You know, it's kind of hard to figure out, but that's really what we wanna know. Or is this really just business as usual and Karimov is doing things with Karimov's Uzbekistan as Karimov has always done, okay? That's what I wanna know. So these are some of the points from the paper and the things that we think are important. We're not exactly sure about his health. There are rumors that, you know, he's pretty sick, and then there's rumors that he's back again. And in fact, this would be a good time to bring up the email. So I will share something with you that you will know about before the President of the United States, because I haven't told him yet. You think I'm kidding? I don't actually talk to the President, but some of the stuff that we write gets up there. So I talked earlier today in my first presentation about having information pushed to you. So what has happened yesterday, the entire management of the Fergana oil refinery was detained. Information is sketchy. Director General and others were detained for questioning. That in and of itself would have been disturbing but not earth-shaking. However, there have been some other events in the past couple of days. Over a week ago, Abdullayev, the nephew of President Karimov's wife, was arrested and charged with embezzlement. Okay, when you have somebody close to the president's family, if you know Uzbekistan, that's an issue. That's an attack. Mr. Abdullayev appears to have been close to the younger Karimov daughter, Lola. Okay, anytime you get the president's daughters involved, that's a big deal. But she was defended by Karimov's older daughter, Gulnara. At one point, Gulnara was viewed as the heir apparent to Karimov, but it's been a problem before there. And it's important to remember that Gulnara owns three television stations. At 24 hours ago, the three TV channels that are owned by Gulnara were shut down. Who, in their right mind, is going to shut down President Karimov's daughter's TV stations? What does it mean? I don't know what the hell is going on in Uzbekistan. Please help. That's why we're here. But we have to think that maybe some of that and everything else has to do with the secession issue, right? What's going to happen? I think everybody's worried about that. We also believe that Uzbekistan, from everything that I've seen, that Uzbekistan, there's that word I've been looking for, that elusive word, exclusive. Russia considers Central Asia to be part of its exclusive zone of influence. Right. So we have very publicly come out and said that we do not agree with that. Sec State has. And recently China has come out and said we don't buy that either. But what does that really mean if so we say that we don't agree with that? Well, Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are very firmly in that sphere of influence, and really nothing we can do is going to stop that unless we were to put a major base over there, which would precipitate lots of problems with Russia. We're not going to do it, right? So for all intents and purposes, with Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, that is actually the case. What's the deal with Kazakhstan? Kazakhstan has its own reasons, but Kazakhstan is big enough to do its bilateralism pretty effectively. Kazakhstan maintains relations with Russia because they tend to be in Kazakhstan's best interest and not because Russia can really bully it into doing so. Okay? But Uzbekistan has always been the one who's been kind of saying, no, we don't want any more of you. Which, if you think of the world in kind of a bipolar world or a bipolar security arrangement, then you could say, well, yeah, then that's good news for the United States. But is it? You know? Would the Uzbeks like us to have a more bilateral, strong relationship with the United States? Absolutely, they would. But is that necessarily the best thing? We have to worry about stuff like that. We believe that Uzbekistan wants to balance Chinese influence with China and the West. Now again, any of these things that you don't agree with or you question, please bring it up. Some of these are not earth-shattering, but you have to, you know, lay the basic foundation in any kind of policy paper. And this is kind of the process that we use. We will get together our little team and we will put this up there and we will invite you to challenge it. So that's a big one. That's a new shift. We'll talk about that a little bit more, and that actually will be a change in US policy. All right, we also believe that that is what they're gonna say. That's what they're gonna want, and that's important for us. Because if indeed Uzbekistan wants to balance Chinese and Russian influences with US, then they will continue to ask for that stuff. All right, and this is us going out on a limb. This is what you do in the policy world, right? You make predictions. Now, it's not necessarily an earth-shattering prediction. I'm just saying there's not going to be a war. But I do think it's going to cause a lot of problems. And what we have to know, we go back to the World Bank studies, which just came out. Now, you guys may or may not be familiar with those, but what's happened is that we, being the international community, has managed to get Tajikistan to kind of back down from building any more of Rogan until we got the World Bank report back. Well, it was late. The Uzbeks are also anxiously awaiting what the World Bank report was. We all were, right? And then the World Bank comes out with its reports and essentially says nothing, which is not helpful to anybody, right? Because now we're back where we were before, and we know at some point or another the Tajiks are going to start construction again, and when the Tajiks start construction, then the Uzbeks are going to stomp and make lots of noises, right? But I think what will happen, and this is me talking, so tell me if I'm wrong or give me some better suggestions. I think what we, the international community, will do will be to assuage them with money or some stuff or whatever, but it's going to be something. And this is, unfortunately, a very true statement in that the Uzbeks are often better partners to us than we are to them. And it's sad to say that. It makes my life difficult sometimes, because every time we go over there and do engagements with them, they're great. The Uzbeks do everything they say they're going to do. They're always quick to sign the agreements that we ask them to sign. And yet, when they want something from us or they ask for some assistance, it takes us a long time. Now, there are some issues there with the human rights stuff, and that a lot of this stuff happens because of that. Every time they go down a tier or something happens, there's an issue, and you can't avoid those human rights issues. But this becomes then a philosophical debate on what do you believe the best way to fix that situation. Is it through more engagement so that you can continue to provide a good influence and hopefully influence them by through more engagement? Or is it that you want to pull back and stop everything? You know, is it the carrot or the stick approach? These are some of the conclusions that we came up with. Now, I'm not sure if it's aggressive bilateralism or not, but I do believe that they are moving towards greater bilateralism. Okay, this is not earth-shattering. But this is important because this is what we're going to use now in terms of how we're going to move forward with setting up engagements and policies. We think Uzbekistan is going to do more bilateral stuff. Now, we don't think they're going to go as far as Turkmenistan, but we think it's going to be more bilateral. I think we are going to see closer ties. China spent $1 billion in Central Asia the last fiscal quarter, $1 billion U.S. dollars. It's hard to say no to Chinese money, but I think that Uzbekistan will continue to use Chinese influence to keep Russia at bay. And I think, we'll get to that in a minute too, I think China is going to take the place of U.S. in this relationship. Now, this is a policy shift for us, or it will be if we get it that way. Somebody else came out with a paper about 2 or 3 weeks ago that said basically the same thing, and I was mad because I didn't get my paper out first. But this is going to be a different kind of road ahead for the United States. We're not used to thinking of ourselves as being in a third place or occupying the third part of anything. We always kind of think of ourselves as, well, we're the United States, so we're either number one or we want to be number one. And I don't think that is going to be useful for us in the near future. I think we can be more useful to Uzbekistan and the region if we sit down and say, you know what, we're going to be the third partner here, but Russia and China will be the more important ones. And that's kind of new for us. And I'm not sure they're going to buy off on that, except for the fact that we have always considered Central Asia to be what we call an economy of force mission. An economy of force mission is if you have the main kind of mission in military terms, the main mission is over here, but you got a bunch of stuff over here. Well, you want to commit just as many resources as you need to over here to either deal with that problem or prevent it from getting larger. Central Asia has always been considered to be an economy of force mission, something that we who like Central Asia never like to hear. But it's the reality of the situation. The good news is that as we do the much touted pivot shift to the east that we're talking about in the government, you know, Central Asia is still part of that, those same countries. They're still going to be part of that as well too. So Central Asia and South Asia will not suffer with that overall U.S. policy shift. Now, this is where we think that we're going to have kind of our advantage. What I have noticed, and this is what I see, because we are the ones who get asked for it, myself, my desk officers, they don't ask for this stuff from Russia. They don't ask for this stuff from China. How do I know this? Because when we go in and we give them, say, a block of instruction on the military decision-making process or NATO intercooperation, well, first of all, the Russians aren't going to give the NATO intercooperation kind of classes to begin with. But in terms of how to think, how to be a professional military, how to be a professional army, they're not asking for that from the Russians or from the Chinese. Otherwise, when I bring in my experts, then what I would have to do is kind of work around what they have. We get to see their doctrines, because you can't get there unless you already know where they're at. So we look at their stuff. They are moving in terms of how they think about security policy. They are continuing to think to the West. Now that is good news, and that provides then opportunities for us to maintain some close cooperation. We do not think that Uzbekistan will stop wanting to become the regional hegemon. I think that will continue to cause friction. That, however, does not jive with this next statement, because Uzbekistan doesn't want to play with its neighbors. So how are you going to be the regional hegemon if you don't want to do anything with Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan? Now, they'll do some things with Kazakhstan, but not a lot. They don't show up to the major exercise that we do every year, which is Step Eagle. Now, they'll do bilateral stuff with us, and we have a huge exercise over there every year. Right? So how can you say that you want to be the regional hegemon, and you want to take the place that you used to have in the Soviet Union, if you don't really want to work too well with your neighbors? And I see both of those trends still continuing to go forward. Please tell me if you disagree. This is going way too easy for me. You guys are just an easy audience. And I believe that no matter what, that Uzbekistan will have to accept some security cooperation with Russia, simply because the post-2014 environment is too dangerous.
Really looking for comments?
Absolutely, I am.
One footnote and then one comment. So one footnote is, you talked about Uzbekistan as kind of the administrative center for Central Asia, and I don't know where that's coming from, I may be wrong, but certainly when Karimov is, or the Uzbeks are thinking about their primary role in Central Asia, it's really pre-20th century, it's historical going, and you know, there's the whole cult of Tamerlane and the notion that they are the true heirs to political power there, and the boundaries, of course, were very, very different. So I would not say that, but consider that a Soviet legacy, it's a pre-Soviet legacy.
Okay.
The other thing is, in my amateurish following of the U.S. relationship with Uzbekistan and the Uzbek relationship with Russia, it seemed to have been vacillating back and forth. They were courting Hillary Clinton when she was first lady. You know, it was like, because you know, you're doing this, and then going back to Russia, and it seemed to be vacillating. And what you have now is you have China coming into Central Asia as third player over the last couple of years. So that's where, you know, you're talking about, are they getting close to Russia? And I don't see how you can ask that without considering at the same time what is going on in the U.S. relationship and what's going on now with the Chinese relationship.
Absolutely, that's what we're trying to figure out. So, So besides the one comment about the it being pre-USSR kind of regional hegemony, what should I change about any of these other ones here?
Well, it was going back. I mean, when you're talking about bilateralism, I think that's oversimplifying it. Looking at it simply in terms of Putin and Karimov, I don't see that you can understand that without considering the U.S. and now China. That's what I'm saying.
Very good point. So what I failed to do is define my terms. Because we're talking about exactly the same thing. So what I'm talking about here is that what we think that we, as opposed to joining a lot of being kind of part of a multilateral, what we see is kind of serial bilateralism with each of its partners. So not quite as far as Turkmenistan, where they do positive neutrality. But what that really means is that they'll do stuff. Turkmenistan will do things with you. They won't do a lot of things with you. And they won't tell you about anything that they're doing with anybody else. That's what positive neutrality means. Doesn't mean that you're not doing anything with them. It just means that it's completely bilateral. It is nothing but bilateral engagements. So whatever they do with China has nothing to do with what they do with Russia. And so my concern, or not my concern, but what I think what we're seeing here is a more, is a shift from Uzbekistan, which used to be kind of more of a bipolar, but now that we have this third player in here, it's exactly what you said, but it's now, it's gonna be, we have to, their relationships are not gonna be multilateral, even though they're gonna stay in the SCO, I believe. That's something else. Would you add that down there, please? I need to put that in there, is that they will continue to be a member of the SCO, and they will continue to keep a role, their leadership role of the terrorism center in Tashkent. Thank you. But it's a policy of bilateralism. So it's that's exactly what I'm saying. We have to now think about this, that Uzbekistan is going to a policy of that's going to focus on bilateral relations. So it will be their relationship with China we have to watch. It will be their relationship with Russia. But in the past, really, Uzbekistan wasn't doing that. They were a little bit more interconnected. There were a little bit more, and we're seeing that kind of pull apart some. Does that make sense? Tell me if I'm wrong. That's why I'm here.
I don't know if you're wrong or right. I'm not an IR person, so I'll try to keep you honest. Don't worry.
No, anybody else? Yes?
So I have a couple of things to throw at you. One, have you considered that they are just hedging in terms of they don't know what the environment is, and so they're trying to have so much, their foot in so many places so that, you know, they can figure it out when the environment actually starts changing. Another thing is, you know, this, I don't necessarily think of a hegemon as necessarily playing nice with their neighbors. They're sort of the kid who runs the playground, not just one of the kids in the playground. So, you know, it's, do we really need them to be nice to their neighbors, to be the hegemon? And finally, what other, like, if you're, they're doing all this bilateral work, who else are they doing these bilateral agreements with, even if it's economic or whatnot?
So they're doing a lot more with China. They are gonna still continue to do some stuff with Russia. They're going to be forced to. They're going to do some things with us. They do have some agreements that they would like to conclude with Iran. They have some things that they would like to do with Pakistan and India as well. And what we're finding is that it's harder for us to know about those because they're not telling us that. But they still want to have good relationships with us. And yes, I've considered the are they just hedging their bets for a while? I don't like that answer, and I don't like that answer because it could be true. And but that's hard to articulate as a policy, so that's part of the reason I don't want that to be the answer. I'd like it to be something more, but it could be right. So would you add that in there as well, too? Would you put in, you know, are they just hedging their bets? And did I address all three of your remarks there?
Hegemon is playing nice with their
name. Yeah, and I'm with you on that. So the Uzbeks I don't believe that the Uzbeks see the idea of a hegemon having to play nice with their neighbors. I think that they want to be in charge. However, the only way you're going to get there, you know, is to either then be a big bully, which they're not going to be able to do because, well, Russia looks like... Well, If you know the background, as I know some of you do, but maybe not everybody, you know, Russia has now come out and said that, hinted to Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, hey, if you sign this base deal and if you do these other things, then we're gonna maybe come down on your side on this rogue and dam issue. Especially since Uzbekistan doesn't want to play, right? So Uzbekistan, as much as they would like to be the regional hegemon or be seen as the power they once were, their only way to do this is not nicely, which is why I say it's going to cause some friction. So they're going to continue to demand that they get the respect that they deserve, but they're not reaching out to their neighbors. So I think you were first.
Okay. So the one thing I see is missing in this analysis is an analysis of what is the interests of the other player. So you talk a little bit about Russia's interests. Well, I'm curious about what's the interest of China in Uzbekistan? Are they interested in raw materials? Are they interested in regional domination? What's their interest? And then what's the interest of the U.S.? I mean, the past few years has been support for the mission in Afghanistan. When that begins to wind down, is the U.S. still going to have a major interest in the region? And the reason I'm thinking about this is I think Uzbekistan's a very, it's very self-interested, and it's very good at reading what other countries will offer it, and then taking the action which will give it the best outcome. So I think to figure out what that is, you have to figure out what are these other countries bringing to the table.
We do address that, but I think you're right in that because the a lot of times I have these assumptions that everybody who reads these things has the same knowledge that I do. So would you please indicate in there that I need to ensure that we've clearly articulated Chinese and U.S. goals as well too? Because I mentioned China. I know Chinese are in the paper, but I'm not sure we articulated our own goals in there, which is right. We need to do that for policymakers. And your second point, please go over that again.
Oh, the idea that Uzbekistan tends to be very self-interested. It'll do whatever will give it the best outcome, and is good at reading what other countries will give to offer it.
Uh-huh.
So it will. So you know, you need to know what these countries are going to be willing to offer to predict.
Okay.
What? How will Uzbekistan, in a self-interested way, take the best outcome?
So then, would you add on the on that sentence that we just put on there, the words "in order to more clearly understand"? What it is that Uzbekistan might want from those countries. In other words, I need to make sure that I connect those dots very clearly for policymakers who don't have the same background that you folks do on this. So that's a very good point, because that needs to be in the paper. So some from this side, sir.
I've been impressed with how stable Central Asia has been since the breakup, and relatively speaking. But just looking to a possible, things going worse in Afghanistan and that kind of unrest spilling over, what about Uzbekistan? You talk about hegemon, but they're also the aggrieved party. The Uzbeks are the minority across the border in Kyrgyzstan, and they seem to get beat up pretty bad in the Osh area recently. I don't know what's happening. Touching part of Fergana Valley, but the Fergana Valley is obviously soft. The boundaries are all soft there. The boundaries with Kazakhstan are also very soft and heavily Uzbek. I mean, what if there was a kind of deterioration of affairs there and in effect, Uzbek either border broke down or Uzbek nationals started to get expelled as refugees or something like that? Couldn't you envision a scenario where sort of out of weakness, adversity, and breakdown, the Uzbeks might assert themselves and be quite capable of doing so?
I do. And that's something that we worry about as well. And so that's why, I'm not sure if it's on this point, I think it's on the next slide that I got here, but that is one of the things then that we have to be very careful about, is that when we offer something to the Uzbeks, we have to definitely see how that will be taken by its neighbors. So sometimes we don't do certain things with Uzbekistan simply because we're afraid that if we build up a certain capability or capacity, you know, how will that be perceived? Will the other partners, will the other Central Asian nations see that as something that could end up in a situation like you just described? So. And you, sir?
Yeah. My perspective on this doesn't come from military at all, but I've become a student of this region. One word that you haven't used that I really think has to be explored is instability, future instability in the region, for lots of reasons. Unfortunately, in a number of instances now, through the course of the war, because the war has propelled U.S. policy in the region, the U.S. is probably more than likely ending up now on the wrong side. If you talk about Uzbekistan as an example, you're talking about a well-documented dictatorship. A dictatorship that is violated by every standard, by every international monitor, on and on and on and on down the list. And you know, I just pulled up the current report on Uzbekistan by Human Rights Watch and Freedom House. And they're separate, reputable organizations, both run through the litany in the 2013 report. And they say, despite this, all the abuses, this is Human Rights Watch, the United States and the European Union continue to advance closer relations with Uzbekistan, seeking cooperation in the war in Afghanistan, of course, cooperation in the drawdown now. Freedom House says, it chronicles its litany of abuses by the regime, says nevertheless, the regime further improved relations with the United States and Europe as it provided logistical support for NATO operations in Afghanistan. I've read numerous congressional reports on the region and on Uzbekistan and so on, and reports by various NGOs and think tanks across the spectrum, and they all talk about the fact that in regard to Uzbekistan, that U.S. policymakers have muted criticism of the nature of the regime in order to accomplish its military mission. So just one, you know, one final thing. You said that Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, basically at the level of IR, are propelled or are in the Russian camp. What has put them in the Russian camp? You mentioned Manas.
50% of the Tajik economy is based on remittances, so that's it right there.
But also,
plus the 201st, which is there, and money and all kinds of things.
But okay, but in relationship to Manas, to the base, two regimes were overthrown, you know, in the 2000s, by popular uprisings in Kyrgyzstan, the Akayev regime, and then the Bakiyev regime. One of the key issues was the amounts of money that accrued to those ruling families, to those oligarchs, through the corruption going on through the base. And that's in the now in the popular memory of the Kyrgyz, okay? Meaning they understand that U.S., in a sense, assisted in the corruption of the society. One final thing. It's vitally important to talk about drug trafficking for these societies. The Tajikistan is commonly referred to as a narco state. Kyrgyzstan is a major circuit coming through the region, and that contributes and will continue to contribute to the instability throughout the region. So, as a student, you know, I'm a U.S. historian by training, by craft. My thinking is that from what I can see of all the variables in play at this point, that the U.S. is going to end up again on the wrong side in so much of this because the war economy, the war on terror economy propelled so much that military thinking.
Can you let our speaker respond?
Sure. It was my last sentence. That I think there's a narrow vision in military propelled foreign policy. So I'll end it there.
Your points, I believe, are all on the money. I mean, anybody who knows this region well knows that there are lots of human rights issues, and that conversation is held in Washington pretty routinely as to what should the level of engagement be with Uzbekistan for exactly what you said. And your narco trafficking comment is something we think about all the time. What I'm trying to wonder about is in terms of policy here, in terms of this paper, what we if we need to add anything in there. So I guess what I would ask you to do is please put in like a question there, you know, run through this for counter-drug policy stuff. Stuff being a technical term, I'll remember that. Any other specific things that you think that we would, in terms of these here so far, that this is not the last slide, but anything else on that? Okay, great.
So I'm going to question I have for you is, you talked about this equipment that's that has been, Uzbekistan wants to get out of Afghanistan as
EDA, right?
Are they looking for other military purchases from Russia, from China, from India?
Yes.
And you know, how are they comparable? Sort of, how does our sale to them affect those other deals?
The Uzbeks are not so interested in purchasing a lot of Russian equipment, but I think, if I remember correctly, they did just, one of the deals they signed with the Russians was to buy some more stuff. But it's not really super technical things. We sell things to Uzbekistan, and then we have a program called Foreign Military Funding, Foreign Military Sales, where we provide couple of million dollars worth of gear to Uzbekistan every year. So some of that we give them, or actually what we do is we give them money so they can then buy our stuff with it. Then we also make some regular purchases with them as well too, and there are some things that they want that I can't talk about because it's classified. I've been wanting to say that the whole class. But there are some things there that we are doing with them. But yes, they are trying to buy things from other folks as well too.
I have two comments slash questions. First, I think it would be helpful to, I would like to know more about why, what the U.S. Position is in terms of why the U.S. cannot be as good a partner to Uzbekistan as Uzbekistan wants to be, i.e. what are the constraints on U.S. further engagement, and what is it that the U.S. wants? But relatedly, with the pullout of Afghanistan, given the situation in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan being connected to Russia, where is the position for the U.S. going to be with regard to Afghanistan if we are only a third party in Uzbekistan? And I mean, is it going to be Kazakhstan? Like, what are we going to do after Afghanistan if we are not deeply engaged in Central Asia? I mean, if Manas is closed down, if things don't go so well in Afghanistan, then what's the next step?
Right. So would you put in there, did you type in everything she said there?
Yep.
Okay, so right, and in particular, I think I'll want to ensure that we mention something in there about if we don't engage heavily, what will happen if we play the third part? That is, and what will that mean? I think that is something that we have to go with, and we've not done any real thinking on that yet, but I think it needs to be done, so thanks for that. And then the first one was kind of a question.
Why can't the U.S. be more engaged in Uzbekistan? Why can't the U.S. say, we want to be the dominant partner? What's stopping us from doing that?
Well, for one reason, there's the human rights issues. So you've got a lot of folks in state saying that there's no way that we should do even half of the things that we're doing. Number two is, if we were to be the dominant partner with Uzbekistan, then Russia, who has a very clear statement on the belief that Central Asia is its exclusive zone of sphere of influence, then that's going to cause some problems, and I'm not sure the State Department wants to deal with that as well too. Russia will get angry if we were to have another base in Uzbekistan, and there wasn't any logistic support from the NDN going through there. In other words, if we had another M2 there with that airbase that we had there for a while, the Russians, they just wouldn't let that happen. They would cause lots of problems. I don't have any data to back that up. You know, I don't have any cables or anything to say that. But it's just all of the other things that we've seen happening in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, whenever those countries do something to get Russia upset, you know, and even some of the statements that we see here, I don't think Russia I think Russia would make it really, really hard for us to be a strong partner there. And then the other part of that is that because we consider this to be an economy of force mission, for us to do that well, that would be a major outlay of resources. And I don't think, even if we could get past the human rights issues with parts of folks in State Department, I'm not sure that anybody wants to spend that kind of money in Uzbekistan, because you would not be able to articulate really a clear and enduring need to have that close of a relationship with Uzbekistan, unless it was just to get Russia, you know? And then that's you know, the old Cold War mentality is something that I have very strongly. And so for me, I have to get past this myself too. It's like, well, if it's bad for Russia, then it's good for me, right? Well, we can't be necessarily thinking that way if what we ultimately want is regional stability. And that is what we want, right? So that's kind of why the whole kind of U.S. in the third role and not necessarily in that kind of thing, that'll be a big kind of change in thinking for a lot of folks in my organization and going up. And that's why that's kind of a big deal for them to even get their heads around that, because that is immediately where they will go. Why don't we want to do more stuff? Because you know what? If we wanted to, we could do an awful lot right now in terms of the types of engagements that we do that would just scare the bejesus out of Russia. And we could do it just to be spiteful, to say, it's not your playground, you're not the only one here, right? We could just do that. But we don't, because, well, we actually believe that multilateral engagements in the region and multilateral organizations bring stability. And the new policy that we have from the president on down really stresses kind of regional cooperation, building partnership capacity and capabilities within the individual countries so that they can then depend on each other and have regional stability, so that we don't have to send our forces every time we go someplace. So that is kind of the grand strategy, and we're willing to spend money to build those capabilities and capacities. But if we're building Uzbekistan and Russia and it gets angry about it, and Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan get frightened, then are we really accomplishing our main task of building regional stability and regional cooperation? And that's where we gotta go with that. So
the first two questions, maybe one, the first one maybe a little bit stupid, but taking into account that in Afghanistan there is no real central government, just a bunch of warlords, and that also Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are, well, not one ethnicity, but also a mixed. I'm not knowing how this is carried out in Uzbekistan, but would it really change the actual policy that much if the central government in Uzbekistan would change in the next days? And the other question, if this dam was to be built, how likely would it be that, taking into account that there will be a lot of money flowing into Uzbekistan, that the water could be supplied by, Kazakhstan?
Or the Aral Sea?
Yes.
That's a joke. for those of you who know Central Asia, that's a joke, right? So water is a major issue. I don't know. I ask, could the water come from any place else that Uzbekistan needs for its cotton industry? I don't think that it could. I think it has to come from those rivers flowing through Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. And those are legitimate concerns on the part of all of those countries.
I've dreamed sort of reverse of the flow of rivers from Siberia, but that's
right. You know. So riparian issues are, I've been waiting to say that all day long, riparian, use the word riparian in a sentence. Riparian issues are a huge deal in Central Asia for exactly that point. So I don't actually think there is another way to do it. And I'm trying to think what your first. If I can't remember the first part of your conversation, it's because I'm listening very closely to everything that you have to say, and then I kind of forget the first part. So that, and the fact that I had to have half my brain removed to go in the army, as you all know. So
the actual influence of the central government.
Oh, I think everybody who knows anything at all about Uzbekistan will agree that that the secession question can play a huge role in anything that happens. So without a clear plan of secession, without, I think that causes a lot of instability now, and I think everything could change overnight. You know, we could actually have complete resolution of the Rogan Dam issue if somebody gets in there who's not so dead set against it and is willing to work with the Tajiks. I mean, the issue could just literally go away, because much of that has to do with personal enmity between Rahman and Karimov. So, did I address your concerns? Okay. All right, let's see if there's anything else that you can pick apart with me. All right, so this is a statement that I would like to make on the future Russian and Uzbek relationship. Please pick it apart. Oh, thank you. A violent extremist organization. That's military shorthand jargon for bad guys who want to kill you. VEOs would include the IMU, Al-Qaeda, any of those violent extremist organizations. The Taliban. Questions, comments? Wrong direction? Okay.
Probably implied in that, isn't there, sort of like, as this gentleman says, implied in that is taking a hands-off relationship to internal events, however repugnant they are.
Well, we can't really do that, so we always have to have a statement on that. So, and then depending on which side of the debate as to how is the best way to stop that, either by engagement or by, you know, is it the stick and carrot method? Depending on which way you see that, you know, that's going to be part of policy. I mean, there's just no way around it. Yes?
Is it possible that, in a way, by engaging with Russia, Uzbekistan is actually trying to increase U.S. engagement?
That's absolutely what Uzbekistan would like. That's what we worry about. Uzbekistan would love us to be more engaged, because then it would be easier to continue to keep Russia at bay. But because they understand that we're going to have an economy of force mission, and post-2014, we're going to be kind of pulling out of the area. Again, if you go back into kind of Cold Warrior mentality, then a lot of the folks in my command are saying, well, that's really bad for us. Uzbekistan wants to be closer to us, and if they don't have us, they're going to go to China. That's bad. So, but is it? And that is the question. You know, is increased cooperation with China a bad thing, when we all know that the Chinese are after world domination?
But in terms of, like, you know, if you're saying that, oh, well, we should maybe just back off, that is perhaps exactly the opposite of what we should be doing.
Well, I don't want to back off. See, I want to maintain what we're doing, but I'm thinking that, I don't know, maybe that's not the best way to do it, and maybe that's the debate that we need to have in the policy circles. So maybe if you would put in there for a comment, please, that maybe instead of making the recommendation about the best way that the U.S. can help Uzbekistan, and change the verbiage to, this should be a further policy discussion, because that is not in my lane, right? That's big P policy. Sir?
Well, So, I mean, just maybe play devil's advocate, why don't we just back off? Why do we care about stability in the region? Why not let the region deteriorate into an internecine conflict that will draw Russia and China in, have them expend their blood and treasure fighting it out with proxy wars in their backyard, where we can concentrate our resources and efforts in places where we're more likely to be able to have a significant influence?
Because we're the United States and we'd like to think that we wear a white hat. Regional instability is bad for lots of reasons because it always is expensive for us. And we don't like it anytime Russia gets into a scuffle on the edges of the Russian Empire, right? We didn't like it when it happened in Georgia. We didn't like it when it was the cyber attack in Estonia. We don't want Russia, well, we don't agree with Russia's stance that they have an exclusive sphere of influence, but we also don't want these countries to suffer or to have instability because it's, well, it's, one way or another, we're gonna have to deal with it. We don't want to deal with it. We want the region to be stable and we would like the neighbors to all get along with each other so that we could have that region stable, because the last thing we need is more instability around Afghanistan. This gets us back to the drug issue. If we don't have a strong Central Asia, then we're gonna continue to have a major drug problem. That area then is just gonna become another vacuum where you continue to have violent extremist organizations able to operate, able to train. So we wanna have a strong region, but we want them to police themselves. Did I articulate that properly?
I would agree with you in response. I think if you think about, you know, what happened the last time we dropped Afghanistan like a hot potato, that's what created the environment where Osama bin Laden, you know, was there, and there was an attack on the United States. And I think a lot of people are thinking if Uzbekistan becomes the next Somalia,
right?
You know, I guess that's the scenario that people in Washington.
So what we say, Barry, is that this is why we call it an economy of force mission. We do not believe that we could just let it go. We just can't believe that we can be hands off. So we need to do something. And then the question is exactly how much and with what. So
by response, I would say if Uzbekistan, if the region was even becoming another Somalia, the countries that would be most endangered by that in the short term would be Russia and China, not the United States. That, okay, yes, yeah, so, you know, bin Laden had a camp in Afghanistan, he used to organize attacks on the World Trade Center. How likely is that to occur, you know, now with the, you know, the new technology of drone warfare with intelligence efforts? Aren't we maybe spending a lot of money and resources to do the work that really benefits Russia and China directly more than benefits us? There are, you know, failed states, problematic areas, chaotic regions throughout the world. This does not seem one where the U.S. is particularly well positioned to exert an influence. There are two other global powers that seem perfectly eager to duke it out between themselves. So why not let them establish a stability and or at the same time bleed one another in their efforts to do so?
Well, the bleeding part I don't think we want to do, but I think in terms of this kind of making a shift towards understanding that we are the third party, you know, and not... I think that's what we're talking about. So it is exactly that, an economy of force mission where when they ask us for some professionalization or they ask us to buy, they want to buy some of our stuff, we'll do that. But we don't necessarily see ourselves where we have to be in Uzbekistan and trying to either become their best partner or keep the Russians out or keep the Chinese out. Let the Chinese and the Russians do that work for us. And then we can, for once, maybe be the good guys instead of having everybody be angry with us. And I think we're there. So you guys were pretty easy on me, but your comments were good, and I think you see. So this is what we'll do. So what I'll do now is I'll take all of this stuff back. I will get some of my analysts on it. We will rethink it. We'll make sure that we do some things with it. And then we will... It'll be a white paper that gets published and goes up. So I first of all want to thank you. I mean, we'll take comments and questions down here, but thank you for your comments. I think I will have a much better policy paper now. And I can feel confident that when these questions come up from leadership at some point, now, you know, I've had to answer them in front of a relatively hostile audience. So thanks very much. And what other comments or questions do you have?
For his comments, and we have a few minutes for informal discussion and talk. So why don't you, if anybody has additional comments, come on up and talk, and we still have room as long as we need.
Great.
Thanks again.